The wonder is that you could start life with nothing, end with nothing, and lose so much in between.
Welcome to the Busy Girls Book Club. We are a podcast reviewing and dissecting the internet's favorite books. All those books that are all over TikTok, we're here to tell you if they're really worth reading, especially if you're busy like us. I'm Casey.
I'm Catherine.
And I'm Caitlin. And today we are bringing you the Pulitzer Prize winning Barbara Kingsolver book, Demon Copperhead. And if you read a little bit more about this book, it's actually a modern retelling of Charles Dickens' David Copperfield, which, not gonna lie, I just thought David Copperfield was a magician. So if you're like me, you've never read David Copperfield. However, it is basically, it follows a character, the titular character, Demon, from birth, basically. Like, the first sentence is, I went and got myself born. And he lives in very rural, like, Virginia in Appalachia. He is descended from Melungeons, which is, like, a mixed Appalachian race. And it follows him through his whole life. And this kid is dealt a really, really bad hand. And it looks into the, like, the redneck culture and racism towards poor white people in the hills who are rednecks, coal mining, the opioid epidemic. It addresses a lot of things, the failure of foster care. And this is set in, like, the 90s, basically. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's sort of, it's not a happy book.
No. No.
But it's there.
Yeah. The way I described it in my Goodreads review was Forrest Gump for Appalachia. It's sort of like, it covers a lot of history. And so there's a lot of history, like, in the background of the story, even though it's not the focus. So yeah, a lot of things that if you're around our age, you'll recognize or will have heard about.
And our mention basically to point out how far removed these people are from the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, do y'all got reviews?
Yeah. I have a 3-star review from Goodreads, and I wanted to go 3-star because I think I wanted to see, like, people who were like, oh yeah, this is a Pulitzer Prize winning novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel bad for giving this, because that was a lot of the theme of the 3 stars. Like, I feel bad. but this court said, I admire this book, but I just don't like it. It's a beautiful piece of literature that has its place among giants, but I found it to be such a slog to get through. Just my personal preference. I can see why so many people love it.
Nice. I mean, fair enough.
Yeah.
This is one of those books where I could not read the 1-star reviews because I'm too sensitive. Like, I'll get too angry.
Do you want me to read you a 1-star review?
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
It's not all I'll read. Both of them made me chuckle. The 1-star says, I guess I'm a prude because I couldn't get over the vulgar language. Also, a well-off woman trying to tell a story of a poor, disadvantaged teenage boy is unsettling to me.
Okay.
All right. I mean, the cussing. Okay, queen. You won't like me either, but.
Yeah.
They're, I want
she's
to
not
read
listening
you
to this podcast.
No.
Yeah.
I want to read you a 2-star also that made me laugh because, ooh, I think you'll see why, but there's a book quote and then it skips to, I mean, 3 stars for the fact that it was well-written book in some aspects, but I'm going to have to downgrade it to a 2 or 2.5 for the ending alone. I think there was just too many cliches, and I feel like the character's backstory was not explored enough. And again, what was that ending? It felt incredibly surprised when I got to the last page. Very unsatisfying and disappointing, in my opinion.
Did we read the same book?
Backstory?
Yeah.
This is why I wanted to read it. I was like,
The whole backstory is there.
Like I said, the first sentence is, I went and got myself born.
Like, does she mean like the backstory of his family? Then yeah, sure.
I'm like, literally the whole book is backstory.
Yeah. It's just anyway. His life.
And I don't know how the ending surprised you if you read the same book. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's his life. Like, it's just, I don't know what you expected.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was funny and wanted to read it.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Okay, I have a few. I think I have two reviews. Okay, 5 stars. This is a lifetime achievement level work. It's like, yeah. Facts.
Period.
And then my next one. None of the reviews, not a lot of the reviews for this book are funny. Like, this is another one where everyone writes whole essays as their review. So this is the other short one I found. Actually, 4 stars. Twists and turns of fortune and a lot of misfortune make for a good story about impoverished children 200 years ago and now, and most likely for all of time. So, yeah. Charles Dickens was compelling in the 1800s, and Demon Copperhead is compelling now.
Have you read Charles Dickens's book, Casey?
I have absolutely not. So, to be fair, I have not attempted Charles Dickens in a long time, but he was one of the only authors we had to read portions of for school that I really did not like. And so I never have like fully read one of his stories.
I'm the same way. So I don't like Charles Dickens' work at all. It's him and Ernest Hemingway that people rave about. And I'm like, no, I have no interest.
I did see someone on the reviews. I spent a lot of time reading reviews because they were kind of fun. But someone said they read Great Expectations. They read David Copperfield and then this back to back. And they said it was the coolest literary experience of their life.
Wow. Hmm. I probably could not suffer through David Copperfield, but I do see how that would actually be, like, from a literary perspective, really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, they're 5 stars. They're a better reader than me.
Listeners, do not suggest Dickens books. We will not be reviewing them.
Also, they're not popular, so fuck you.
Yeah. I know, Christmas Carol.
Yeah. The movie's popular. Let's be real. No one's reading the book.
Yeah, correct. Also, yes. True.
Correct.
Okay. Well, the overall Goodreads rating is 4.5 out of 5, and the Amazon rating is 4.6 out of 5. Which I think is extremely impressive for a book that is like really long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really long and not in an SJM way, like really long in a classic literature way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where do y'all come down?
I gave this 5 stars. While it's not like my favorite book I've ever read, not even close. The writing, the detail, the stuff I learned, the stuff I felt was just like incredible. I understand why it has a Pulitzer. Yeah. And even though it was super long and took me forever to get through, I was never bored. Like, I really enjoyed reading the book, and there was like cuts of humor to keep it, keep you from being like too bogged down by it. I just thought the amount of detail and the amount of work that was put into this book to tell this story of a very niche America was really, really good.
Yeah, I also gave it 5 stars. I did not enjoy the book, but I respect it hardcore. I like, because I try to find a way to say it. Like, it took me over a month to read, and that's like unheard of in my reading experience. So like the story itself, I loved the character. I found it hard to pick up and put back down because it is so character focused and it's very long, and there were moments where like we were texting each other of just like, I read 20 pages and it took me 2 hours. Like, it's just kind of like one of those books.
Yeah, we were supposed to record this episode like a week ago.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely I second those opinions. I also give it 5 stars.
Ooh.
I know. I feel like this book has actually become like really special to me. Like it's one of those books that just like really, really stays with you and stays in your mind. And like, despite actually being a really, really sad story, it's like it leaves you with a lot of like really good people and a lot of high points and a lot of points of hope. And I think that's really hard to do. I loved Demon. Like he's one of my favorite main characters. So yeah, even though the book did take a long time to read, I mean, she is thick and she is slow. I felt kind of like Caitlin, where I was never bored and I was always happy to keep reading it. But yeah, to me, it made the opioid epidemic real. And I feel like I had really never been able to connect with it in a way that made sense to me and kind of like felt like the gravity of it like made sense. And so I think that's kind of this book's crowning achievement.
Yeah, like when we were born, it had just started where like Purdue Pharmaceuticals was going into these communities and selling a shit ton of opioids to people in pain. And so we grew up through the ramifications of that. So we all know someone who has an opioid problem or like a family member who has an opioid problem. It's like the degrees of separation. But I've never truly felt as connected as I was with Demon and how he could break down, and I guess Barbara could break down it into like a very simple form and say, like, this is what's happening in this region of America, and let's not degrade them for it. Let's blame the actual people who should be blamed for it. These people were in pain, and someone promised them to get rid of their pain. Without realizing that, well, with them realizing, the people not realizing that it would create even lifelong struggles.
Well, and here's where that review I read that said it was weird for a affluent woman to write a teenage boy like that. She grew up here. This is her personifying everything she saw in her community. In a way that only someone who grew up and experienced that life and watched people deal with this could have. And so I think that's really interesting too. Like, she's probably the right person to write this.
100%.
And my
That's
guess is she wrote a boy because boys were probably a little bit more victim to all of these things than girls.
No, I think that's a really good point. And I do feel like it just so, because I kind of see what people are saying where like the book hits a lot of stereotypes, but I think the book is a really good example of how you can technically tell the same story in a really unique way. Like the story of the opioid epidemic is not new at this point, you know, like those stories have been written, those movies have been done. But to me, she wrote it in a way that made the stereotypes real and impactful instead of just being like derogatory or overused or simplified. Like, you know, it was really a complicated and deep book.
No, it
So,
hit all the stereotypes in order to dismantle them.
exactly. To be like, let's look deeper into this.
And I would say a lot of the storytelling that's been done about the opioid epidemic has been mainly docudramas or mainly just like nonfiction books, which, granted, that's very useful and helpful to get the facts. But I think where you hit people is when you hit their emotions. And a nonfiction book doesn't necessarily elicit such emotions as a fiction book does. And so this is hitting a new chapter of this story. And I think she does an amazing job at really telling the story in a thorough way without just parachuting in and parachuting out. Like, I feel like a lot of journalists and a lot of documentary people just parachute into a community, record it, and then leave. So we see that in snapshot moment of how opioids affected a person, but we don't see the aftermath after that camera crew leaves.
Well, and she still lives in Appalachia, so. Since we're so excited to discuss, More plot or character driven?
Character. Yeah.
100% character.
Oh, demon.
Have you or would you read other books by the author?
So this is a point I was excited to discuss today because
I guess which one you've read?
Yes, I think I mentioned it before.
You read the Poisonwood Bible?
Mm-hmm. You have.
Yeah. The Poisonwood Bible kind of changed my life. So yeah, okay. It was another book that I read that like really has stayed with me. I read it my senior year of high school and I still think about it to this day. So when I picked up Demon Copperhead, I actually didn't realize it was the same author, but like now that I finished it and it like kind of connected, I was kind of like, oh, that kind of really makes sense. And also it's crazy that this woman has written two books that just like impacted me so deeply. But I wanted to rant a little bit because some people are so crazy. And this is the review that I saw where I had to stop reading the 1-star reviews because some woman had given it a 1-star review and was like, I should have known I would hate this. Like Barbara Kingsolver writes like white savior narratives. And this is another white savior story, just like the Poisonwood Bible. And I was like, babe, it's not a white savior narrative if everyone in the story is white. Okay. A white savior narrative.
The main character is actually sort of not all
white. He's actually like really not white. Yeah. But I was
also,
like,
he's not saving anyone.
I know.
He saved himself.
Yeah,
exactly. I was like, white savior narratives are when white people get all the credit for helping people of color. So this is not a white savior narrative.
It's the Poisonwood Bible.
The Poisonwood Bible. The white people are the villains. We are not supposed to like them. It's told from their perspective, but they're the bad people. Like they don't save anyone. They actually almost get people killed. Like it's what are you reading the books? So yeah, I love Barbara Kingsolver.
Yeah, I think. Interesting. She 100,000% deserved the Pulitzer for this book.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this book is not technically for everyone. Like most Pulitzer Prize winning fiction, it's hard to read.
Yeah, I would pick up another one of her books.
I've
Poisonwood Bible.
I've been
also interested because she was a missionary kid in Congo for a while. So
yeah,
she's writing from her own experiences.
She is like she literally like lived that stuff.
So I'd definitely be interested.
Right. I've read several other of the modern Pulitzer winners and I honestly haven't been that impressed by them. Like I can see why they win from a craft perspective, but my gripe with the Pulitzer Prize winners is I think they pay too much credence to craft and not enough to story. And so I'm like, I think to me, you should have craft, but you should also have a compelling narrative. And I feel like a lot of the Pulitzer Prize winners are boring. So if you're going to read a modern Pulitzer, I actually think that this is like one of the better ones.
Yeah, I think recognizing the accessibility of literature is a problem mm-hmm. that Pulitzer has not totally figured out because I mean, I'm not saying SJM deserves a Pulitzer, but there's a reason why SJM outsells a lot of other people is because of accessibility.
Uh-huh.
No way am I saying that she deserves a Pulitzer, but she has an accessible story and an accessible narrative, and mm-hmm. she's a great writer. But we only ever see very like character-driven stories that are harder to read if you're not at like a college level reader. And it's like, mm-hmm. why don't we pay some homage to like lesser, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like that's
stories,
how I feel about it.
Stories people enjoy.
Yes. They're very like intellectist.
Yeah. Yes.
But nice way of saying elitist, but okay.
Yes, they are very elitist.
Even necessary. I don't know. Like I was headed towards elitist, but I was like, it's not quite.
I get it. Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of accessibility, how long did this book take you to read?
I already said a month and a half, so y'all need to answer now.
Yeah. Mine, I think, was a week and a half. It probably would have taken me longer if I didn't have the podcast deadline. But yeah, I would think for a normal person, it's kind of at least a 2-week read.
Probably more. Mine was about probably like a week and a half too. And that was just sitting down and reading for like a solid week when I got home from work. Like Casey said earlier, or Catherine, I think you could sit down and read for like 2 hours and be like 20 pages in. I was like, yeah. Oh no. Like I was like, man, I've made so much progress. I sat here in bed all evening and then I'd be like 100 pages. I was like, this is bad.
Yeah. Like, oh shit.
I felt like, you know, like swimming against a lazy river. Yeah.
Yeah. You look up and you've made no progress. Yeah.
You're still enjoying yourself, but you're not going anywhere.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
It's a great way of describing it.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, would you watch a movie or TV show of the book?
It would be so hard to do this book, but yes, if they did it correctly.
So I thought a lot about To Kill a Mockingbird while reading this book. So if you did it right, you could probably do something similar. However, there is so much like really minor stuff mentioned that make the whole story that it would be hard.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like there's a few really good sort of like coming of age narratives that have been done well. But it would be a long movie. Like, it would probably be a 3-hour movie.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And I don't think anyone would sit through that, if I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, I feel like it would almost have to be for, I feel like literally every time I'm like, if A24 did it, because I'm so obsessed with them. But it's just kind of true. It's like you need that kind of like artful, like audience and like highbrow approach, I think.
Elitist,
exactly. you need the Pulitzer version of movies, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Arguably the most interesting point of this episode was your busy girl rating.
I mean, it's like a 0 or a 1. Like, it's not for the busy girl.
No. Yeah. I think I'm going to give it a 1. I don't think it's quite as bad as Babel to me, because I think it's just a little easier to get your head around.
Agreed.
But it's still a slow read. It really is. And I always wanted to pick it back up, but I don't think there's a lot of great points to do so. Like, it's just, it's not written in, what's that style Virginia Woolf does where it's just, stream of consciousness. It's not written in stream of consciousness technically, but it kind of feels like it. So you just like, it's hard to just break it off.
Yeah, it's not a 3-act structure book. It is totally just a lifeline.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm going to give it a 2.
Wow.
Because while it takes forever to read, I never didn't enjoy it. And I do think people should read it because I learned a lot and gained a lot from this book and will probably think about it for the rest of my life. So.
Oh yeah. I will forever think about this book and quote back to this book whenever I'm talking about these topics. Like, she's made a lifelong fan of me.
So I'm going to stick with it too.
Nice. All right. Well, I think that brings us to our spoiler alert section. Spoiler alert. Go read the book, come back in a month and listen to this podcast.
We did have a few people like ask us to read this, so people have
I feel like we should apologize for how long it's taken us. It's been on our list for like literal months, but we've just pushed it back, and then we finally got to it, and then we pushed it back again because it's just been such a long book to read and fit into schedules.
Yes. Busy girl life. But okay, question 1. So the sort of main theme of this book is addiction and how it has impacted Appalachia. In the beginning, the sort of connection to addiction is through Demon's mom, and sort of the drug addiction of the grown-ups in the book. What did you think about that and how everything kind of ends up being cyclical, and you see how the children are then pulled into the same problem.
It was like reading a slow motion disaster. Mm-hmm. Like, you knew it was coming, and you were like, he got so close so many times to breaking the cycle.
Yep.
And then something just caught, beat him back. And it was really upsetting to read, but important.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I think a slow motion crash is the perfect way to describe it. Like truly slow motion, like 400 pages of slow motion. And you're just sitting there watching and waiting, and it's painful in like the best way, because you're rooting for the character so hard, but you can also understand why he's making the choices that he's making and why he's, you know, exposed to these things, why it's so hard to escape. And yeah, I really did appreciate the sort of thoughtful portrayal of, like, because the adults in the book are all doing their best. A lot of them are failing. Like, Demon's mom is failing, but she's really trying. And so you can, like, have sympathy for her, even if you can see how she's, like, hurting her child. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that part of it.
Yeah, I think, because it's so sad, because Demon is obviously very bright and very smart, and he sees the world very realistically, but also he's not letting it completely destroy him, which, like, if I was in his position, I'd probably break down and, like, I would hate everything, hate the world. But he always seemed to find some sort of happiness to hold on to, or, like, he fell in love really deeply and, like, didn't put walls up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really tragic, because, like, in the first, like, two thirds or, like, half, he doesn't really have an addiction or problem. He's just doing it recreationally for fun, because they're bored, they're teenage boys. It's bound to happen when it's in such huge supply. And it doesn't truly happen for him, and bringing him into the cycle of addiction until he gets prescribed opioids. And then he says, like, I want to get off, but every time I get off, it feels like more pain than I've ever experienced in my life, like the withdrawal. And so it's so tragic, because he's so smart and he's so bright, and he's, like, making sure that he's not going to ever OD. He's just doing it to stay alive and stay out of pain.
Mm-hmm. When you see every aspect of the crisis and the, like, ripple effect.
Mm-hmm.
So you get, and now I just forgot his, like, his friend, his bestie with the long hair.
Maggot.
Why did I forget that? Maggot gets drawn in, but his addiction turns towards, like, hard drugs. And then Emmy gets drawn in, and hers turns towards, like, prostitution. And then you have the people who, like, they mentioned at the funeral home, tried it the first time, and that was too much, you know? And then the people, like, Hammer, who get, you know, brought in other ways. You have the people who are dealing it, the people who are, you know, chasing it. And it's like every small aspect of this is shown in the book, which is really masterful, that you look back in the moment, you don't realize it, but afterwards, like, whoa, I saw every way this could have gone.
At the very start of the book, this is really a throwback, but they kind of set it up with this talk about copperhead snakes being everywhere in the trailer park. But Demon is like, there's no way that's true, because I've never seen a copperhead. And, you know, everyone has this nickname, and there's a ton of characters. So what did y'all think of just, like, the whole beginning, the setup, all the people?
I have seen a copperhead. I just want to say that, like, I saw a mother copperhead with her nest. And it was nested underneath a place structure at my camp.
Yeah, we got them all over Missouri.
Yeah. And so one of the camp counselors, this is a really off tangent story, but I felt like I need to say it. One of the camp counselors was a Marine, or a former Marine. So he literally picked up the copperheads and just used a machete and chopped the heads off of all the copperheads.
Oh my God.
It was a very aggressive mother copperhead in a nest structure where kids are, so he can't leave them there. But I was like, It was a formative experience with Copperheads. I know that has nothing to do with the question, but
yeah,
I mean,
that's wild.
I liked the setup of this because A, everyone thinks about some experience they've had, you know, and B, it sets up the lore, which is very Appalachia to have mm-hmm. these kind of lores. And it mentions like the snake handling churches mm-hmm. along with that, and how that, you know, you've kind of got like the butt end of the Bible Belt over there, and they're doing weird things, you know, and it starts to introduce all these things by simply mm-hmm. using his name. Also introduces his hair color and the Melungeon race, which my favorite, like, people, if you ever ask, like, what's a weird fact that you are obsessed with that no one else knows? And mine is always like, it's very likely Abraham Lincoln was a Melungeon, and people are like, what are Melungeons? And I was like, I actually know this. And so it was fun to see like this really niche Appalachia stuff tie together just by, hey, my name's Demon Copperhead.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not actually his name. It's his given like nickname, which is so
Damon Fields.
Yeah. Damon Fields. And I mean, like, they're always so on the nose with their nicknames. It's like kind of hilarious and funny. And it's very interesting way of doing the story. And like how the people looked down on Demon and his like kin and his situation, but like they're no better off. But then they're also like, yeah, look at them out with the copperhead snakes. And it's just like, I've never seen a copperhead snake. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know what you're talking about. So they're comparing those people to the snakes. And so it really brought in, because that's like the first 25 pages, it really brings in all of the prejudice that's put against Demon and like how he's from birth set up for failure.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I really liked the beginning. I think it sets the tone really well, kind of like you were saying, Caitlin. It does a good job of like introducing this sort of like folksy culture and like sort of a land of like myths and lore and stories and like a really tight-knit community. I personally didn't really find the book confusing. I felt like every character who ends up being important is distinct enough. And the nicknames actually really helped because the nicknames are really distinctive. So it's not like having to remember the difference between like Matt and Ben and Claire. It's like,
well, they are so on the nose, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you remember who Demon is and who Maggot is, like,
and then you remember, forward. Yeah. U-Haul, Hammer.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a lot of characters. Like, let's be clear. We meet the entire town essentially in Lee County.
And a good amount of them die.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is skipping ahead, but I think that was another really, I hate to say good because it was sad, but the book accomplished its mission because you can really see how the opiate epidemic hollowed out the community. Like mm-hmm. you can see how, you know, children lost their parents, then children themselves died, like grandparents died, like just the way it kind of took apart their social networks.
Well, and even like June, who's fighting it, the one person who is aware of the epidemic and is fighting it, it's kind of like ruined her life too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because her adoptive daughter basically gets sucked into prostitution. Because of the opioid epidemic and because of the situation she was put in Lee County.
Right. And she's screaming into a void, moves back to help with this and screaming into a void.
Yeah. Right. It's every time June showed up, I loved those scenes because June was like the only reasonable character because she was mm-hmm. the only one who saw through the bullshit. And she, because she had a lot of education and she has education mm-hmm. on opioids and she saw the smoke and mirrors, she saw behind it and said, why are you prescribing this to a 15-year-old? And why aren't you just doing a surgery? Like, why are you just giving him pain meds and telling him to go fuck off, essentially? Mm-hmm. And so I really loved June for that.
Well, and Demon realizes in the end, he's like, oh, all along, this mother figure I've been looking for has been right here.
Yeah. No, it was very good. June was one of my favorite characters. And
oh, yeah.
Because she's just so smart and like she's a fighter. And I think the book really needed that like character to be like the one person who was like ringing the alarm bell, you know,
Well,
because she was able to break out and, you know, was college educated and knew how to call out a system.
Well, and she could have just left and never come back and never looked back. Because, right. I mean, no one would blame her in her situation because it is truly getting out of a bad situation in a community that's only going downhill. But she sees that as home and she feels that she needs to help save her community, which is super admirable.
It talks about like the small town kind of suction, like,
yeah,
these people, even when they leave, come back because the close knit community is a draw. Being out in nature is a draw, you know, like there are things that keep bringing them back. And that's another reason no one can get out is because they like being there.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts that I think for me is why I don't agree with it when people say this book is like built on stereotypes. Because I think, you know, a lot of the narratives about Appalachia like really look down on the region and they're kind of like, why would you live here? Oh, the only reason people live here is because they're poor and they can't get out and like, you know, very derogatory. But I felt like when I read this book, I could really feel the love for Appalachia. Like when I didn't know that Barbara Kingsolver was from there, but when you told me that, it made so much sense because it's just, you know, Demon loves it there. He loves the nature. The descriptions of living so close to nature are so beautiful and like tender. Like this, you can feel like the affection for the area. And I think that is really valuable way to look at it. If this is not just like a hollowed out place that people are stuck in, like this is a place that people really love and they love living this way. And they care about each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, this kind of goes into our next question of what y'all thought about the setting and the time period specifically, because this was just right around the time we were growing up. And the setting is idyllic almost in Barbara Kingsolver's like descriptions, like even very terrible scenes, like the devil's bathtub and stuff like that is described as this very beautiful, natural place. Mm-hmm. And it's the people that maim it. Like it's not her saying like, oh, screw Appalachia. Like she's not saying that. She's saying like, look at this beautiful place with all this potential and with these very nice people who are taking care of each other, essentially like driven
resilient
to this
people.
Yeah, resilient people driven to this madness that has been thrust upon them by higher powers that have never been there before. They don't know the community.
I do love it's post coal mining, and then because of what coal mining has left them as, they're targeted by opioid dealers, and so you find this like very it's just so specific, like, you know, I've driven the Smoky Mountains. When I drive them, I do not think about, you know, I've been to North Carolina, I don't think about this stuff when I'm driving through there. I'm just thinking, oh, how beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
It's very interesting how the community itself as a makeup is also part of the setting, and like the time period is very important. And they're referencing like Disney Channel is on in the background, and that like brings you back. You're like, oh wait, I was watching those shows too. But my childhood was very different. I was also going to Friday night football games, but it wasn't the only ticket out of my town, you know?
Yeah.
Some towers fell in New York, but really didn't affect us here. It was like, other than army recruiters started pouring in to get the poor kids, you know?
Right.
I thought the setting, I thought it was amazing.
Yeah. The That's So Raven call out really hit close to home for me.
I was like, whoop. I kept trying to picture this in like, you know, like the 60s, and I was like, never mind.
Yep. No, it definitely, the time and the place felt very strong and very real and like fully fleshed out, fully researched. But yeah, one of the other things I really liked that's a little tangential to this point but it comes when Tommy talks about the difference between a land economy versus a money economy.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that was actually like very revelatory for me because, I mean, I grew up in a city, so I'm just like used to viewing like value and like taking care of myself and like blah, blah, blah in this way. And I never really like fully connected before that, like, if you are like living in these rural communities, like you really don't benefit from participating in capitalism the same way. And like how that kind of has fed into this whole system of people taking advantage of Appalachia, like whether it be like with opiates and military recruitment and all this stuff, because they cannot be used for gain, like from corporations, like they're not seen as valuable.
Well,
or tobacco farming.
Yeah. Like, it's crazy to me because like that same part really shook me. Like, I had to put the book down and like really think about and digest it. Because mm-hmm. even Tommy says, like, we blame the city dwellers and we blame like the people in these urban communities for this, but it's not. It is the government pitting us against each other. And I was like, wow, like Barbara Kingslover could have taken the very easy route of urban versus rural that's been taken apart mm-hmm. time after time, where it's just like, look at the country versus the city dwellers. Mm-hmm. And she could have done that. And instead, she like went even deeper and said, why are we being pit against each other? Why do we make money and making money the number one goal? And is that right? Why? Like, it was so, so fascinating and just beautifully done, where Tommy's just like, I got it. Like, we need to shout this into the world. Like, just because we're different doesn't make us wrong.
Well, and Damon talking about, even as a child, he's realizing, whoa, it's way better to be homeless in the country than the city, because in the country, you've got kinfolk or a neighbor who's going to help you out and help you up. And in the city, you're sleeping in a box. And like, this child observing this
mm-hmm.
is fascinating. And you see it play out quite literally with his life there briefly. Like, and it is, it's interesting. You know, I'm in suburban Kansas City. I see the city, I see the cycle of violence in the city and how people can't get out of this cycle there. But also I have family in like rural middle of nowhere Kansas, which mm-hmm. feel like their own little isolated spot, kind of like this, like Ken is always going to help you up and out no matter what goes on. It's kind of that economy. So like, seeing two things I know like about, but seeing them pitted specifically together in this story was really interesting. I learned more.
Yeah.
100%. Well, because we all kind of grew up either tangentially next to a city or in a city.
Right.
Okay. So this brings us to our question about the beloved main character. We send so much time in the head and in the perspective of Damon/Demon. What did you think about him and how he told his story?
I thought it was so fascinating how it was him talking about the past, like as if he was writing this novel himself of his life. Mm-hmm. Because like mm-hmm. you see snippets of it. It was just like, wow, I was a dumbass, essentially. Like, I wish I had not known what was happening next. It could only get worse from here. And I think that's what gave it some even more character, was that you're not just in mm-hmm. his head. You're in his head in the future, looking back on the past.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like he's telling it from like it's like his recovery. Part of his recovery story is looking mm-hmm. back. And so it's really interesting because he is identifying like, this is where everything went wrong, or this is where it almost went right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. Like, I think him, the way it's narrated, it's very important to the story. And I liked how it was written. I think some people didn't like how it was written in the reviews I saw were like, eh. Mm-hmm. But I mean, thought it was perfect way to tell the story.
I said this to Caitlin before last week, I think, where I was just like, I find it hard personally to get into books from a male perspective. just because I think a lot differently. And I do prefer female main characters just for my own bias. And so I did have some trouble getting into this book because I was like, okay, so teenage boys act like teenage boys. And I'm not a prude or anything, but some of the things I was just like, can we not? Like, just can we not like objectify women like that? And like, it was fine in the story. Like, it wasn't like in a bad way for the story, but like in my own reading, I'm like, that's cringe. Like, did we have to objectify the woman there? Okay, cool.
Yeah, but you got the exact setting, you know.
Yes.
Time, place, atmosphere, people's vibe.
Oh, I'll defend it. Like, it's
also, it's a boy written perfect. By a woman, so like
it's better. Yes. Better. But like, I just, yeah, it's like I thought at first this was going to be a secret history issue. It was not. Yes. Thankfully. Uh-huh. But I thought it was going to be a woman writing a man, and they're going to write like this terrible man who is like one dimensional and has no growth, and is just like objectifying the women around him. But no, thankfully that was not the case.
Yeah. No, it's a little boy learning the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I loved Demon. I loved his perspective. The book is so long that you'd think I'd be tired of him by the end, but I really miss him. I'm like, he's so funny. I loved how funny he was. I think it was the right choice to tell the narrative as him speaking, like in hindsight, because it gives you that kind of like assurance that he'll be okay. And in some books that sort of like gives something away, like a certain amount of tension. But in this book, I think you really needed it because some of the situations were so hard that you really like needed to know like a payoff was coming. Mm-hmm. So I really think that was a good way to do it.
Absolutely. What about his bestie Maggot and the Peggots? And I found them specifically the most heartbreaking at that point, because he was like, "Can't I live with you?" And they were like, "No."
Yeah. Oh, so bad.
But they're like the pride and joy of Lee County.
Mm-hmm.
And but then Maggot is gay. And so there's a lot of dynamics in this family. What do you think about their good old neighbors?
So the Peggots were another bright spot that's really complicated, because you understand why they won't take Maggot in, but you also understand that he's like kind of being let down. And so you feel a lot of feelings, like at least I was mad at them, but I also like got it, because they're poor themselves. They're already busy like raising the second generation. Like
they're old,
like they have health problems. So you understand both perspectives, because they're really good people, but you know, they're not able to be the heroes that Demon wants or needs at that point in his life. And I also really liked that like Maggot being gay sort of plays out in the background of the narrative, but like reading closely, you kind of like pick things up, and like you can tell that's part of his addiction issues, of just like feeling like he doesn't fit in and not being able to like understand himself and like all the clashes with his family. But I really liked him as a character. It's sad, but yeah, it was a good part of the narrative.
Yeah. Cause like the Peggots, it's heartbreaking that they don't take Demon in, but they've taken in so many of their own kin. It's almost like you understand when they make the argument of like, you're not our blood, so we don't feel like this sense of obligation to take you in. But it is heartbreaking, especially when Stoner bans him from seeing Maggot and the Peggots, and basically screws up his chance of being like fostered there, because he's like accusing them of abuse or something like that. And it's just heartbreaking, because you know that these are good people who are just trying to get through life and like raise a semi-functional family. And then you have Maggot, who doesn't see anyone like him around him. And mm-hmm. so he's lashing out and acting out because he is already being called slurs even before he even comes out and dates anyone. Like when he's a kid, he's called that. So it's just, it's heartbreaking. And then like when they kind of drift away in the middle of the narrative, I was like kind of sad where I was like, oh, I want to see them again. I want to make sure that Maggot's mm-hmm. okay and stuff like that. Yeah. But that's such is life.
And despite everything and them not being able to take Demon in, they still are very present in checking in on him
mm-hmm.
and making sure that he's all right and saying, hey, like you and Maggot got to stick together,
mm-hmm.
all this sort of stuff. You know, they still include him as part of the family, which is nice. It's also really interesting on the topic of Maggot and his sexuality, how the biggest argument any family member had with him over his identity is please cut your hair. Like they had bigger problems to worry about. No one in his family cared at all how he identified. And I feel like that's so different than a lot of experiences we read about where, you know, the family isn't supportive of someone coming out and stuff. But no, they had much bigger problems in their lives. They did not care about the kid's sexuality.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they were supportive of it. I think they've just
but they're not ostracizing
it.
Him no. And they weren't like, you know, they treated him just like another family member. They just were like, can you cut your hair? Do you have to wear that makeup? You know, and typical grandparent things.
And because of his mother and her very tragic backstory and where the justice system completely failed her mm-hmm. and her abusive situation, I think they feel like if that wasn't the situation, I have a feeling they wouldn't have accepted him as willingly as they did.
Possible.
But the good news is that even at the end where they mention like him and his mother are living together and he has a boyfriend and it took Miss Peggy a little bit to come around, but she was okay. It's because they have gone through so much hardship and turmoil and that like, she's like, I finally see you happy. Like I'm finally seeing you not drunk or not high. And you
right, and
are,
that's ultimately all she wants for him.
You are safe and happy. That's all I want.
And I was going to echo that point you made, Catherine, about, you know, circumstances sort of encouraging acceptance, because I felt that way about like the drug addictions and everything as well, is they were like, look, like, we'll accept you. Like, please just don't do drugs. You know, like, we'll accept you. Like, please just don't do meth. Like, don't let these feelings, you know, put you in a place and in a position where you totally derail and ruin your life. And so I think that definitely also made everything make sense, because the stakes were so high. Like they knew he was kind of walking this line and they were like, look, like, we don't care. You can have a boyfriend. We don't care. Just please like keep mm-hmm. yourself intact.
What about one of you mentioned Stoner just a bit ago? So Demon's mom and Stoner, her husband, she remarries, who is a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about how this storyline, this careful balance between Demon and his mom, Demon basically keeping his mom alive, and then Stoner comes in and kind of tips the scales? What do you think?
This was one of the most like disappointing like parts of the narrative for me, because again, like, Damon's mom isn't a good mom, but you still feel for her, like you're still rooting for her. And you can kind of understand the things she's dealing with. And so, but the decision to marry Stoner was like one of the ones that is like the worst. Like that's kind of where for me things veered over to more like addict you can sympathize with to like bad mom, is I was like, now you've welcomed someone into the family who is like abusing you and your child. And it was just like such a bad choice. And then she dies. And I was like, wow, what a failure.
Well, and I think she's just one of those people, you know, there are those people who just, no matter how much good advice they're given, the common sense on their it's just non-existent. Like, mm-hmm. everyone else could see Stoner was a bad dude. Her 10-year-old child could see Stoner was a bad dude. And it's just, there are people who go through life and miss every red flag there is. And so you're watching this
up. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're watching this. And while she had been sober for a while, she still doesn't have a lot to her name. And it was like, hey, this guy's giving me attention.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. I think the saddest part of it all was her overdosing while pregnant. And Demon, just like his feelings about that were really complex. And he's like, no one else knows except me that there are two bodies in that casket. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. That was heavy and hard. And I think her whole relationship with Stoner just kind of shows her battle with addiction. I think addiction spans across more than drugs. It's mm-hmm. addictive personalities. It can mm-hmm. be getting yourself into wrong situations no matter what, because when you're battling with that kind of psychological impact that you have with addiction, you're going to make poor life decisions and you're going to stay with people that aren't good for you because they feed your addiction or they fill a need that you feel like you need, I guess is the best way to say it. So I was just, it was heartbreaking. Like, I almost cried reading that, of like, this, you just left this 11-year-old boy on his birthday with a guy who basically controls his fate and doesn't want him. And
right, that was extra sad, is the scene where young Demon is trying to impress Stoner enough that Stoner will take him in so he doesn't have to go into foster care. And you're like, so the worst possible situation is still the best one for him. Like, it's heartbreaking.
Oh, it was so awful. Knowing that his mom was molested does make it make more sense, because I feel like you can see her like PTSD work out in that relationship, where she just like constantly seeks out abusive situations because she has a lot of like pain and trauma that she has not dealt with. It was so heartbreaking. And like you said, Caitlin, like, the best option is a horrible option.
Yeah, there's no good examples of good relationships in this book.
The Peggotts were okay.
And the Miss Annie and Mr. Armstrong.
Yeah. They were so sweet.
Well, and funny enough, his like grandmother he finds and Uncle Dick are really,
but I meant romantic relationships.
Oh, romantic.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not very many of those.
They're all problematic.
So if you don't have good role models, you're not going to make great decisions for your life.
Right. Okay. So another huge part of the book is Demon's experience in foster care. You know, what did you guys think of that? And also some of the people who were kind of working outside the system, like Betsy Woodall.
I freaking love Betsy, because she was just like, nah, the system's broken. I'm just going to do this on my own. And it works out a lot better with Betsy than it does with anyone else. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that people should work outside the system, because the system is in place to protect children. But I will say CPS is broken.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. Yeah, it does not serve children as well as it should.
Yeah,
but it looks at how underpaid the people are too.
Yes.
So like, you're getting what you pay for. When it, sorry, as someone who works in education, when it was like she got a pay raise, the first grade teacher, I was like, oh my god, like, it's so bad. And also, like, I see daily my sister's kids in school who are more privileged than Demon, but still have really bad situations in life, and they'll hotline call to CPS and they're like, well, they're being fed and clothed. That's really, like, they're good.
Well, because like you said, CPS workers are grossly underpaid, social workers in general, and they're expected to deal with a whole host of different issues.
Yeah, the worst stuff.
And they are well overworked, where they're having multitudes of case files lining their desk, where they have to basically, like I said, with journalists, just drop in and parachute in moments and then parachute out. Like, that's all they're doing at this point, because that's all they can do, because a person only has so much time in the day to work. And if you're not being paid for it, then why would you ever work 24 hours a day? So it's an unfortunate situation. We have defunded and undervalued our social workers and our child protective services. I think the system's bones and foundation is good. We just need to like overhaul most of the administration stuff and most of how we fund it. And yeah.
But there's also, as it talks about, crisis of too many kids, you know?
Yeah.
Too many kids that need help, which is really sad too. And so I think that his grandmother is kind of like, well, I can't take you, but I know someone who will because they owe me, you know?
Yeah.
And then the lady, his like case agent, is like, oh, okay, cool. Not my problem anymore.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Well, because it's just like, you can place them. Like, great. Finally, I can get this open case file off my desk.
Right. And not to get too political, but we're in a moment when lots of governments have decided that we should be having children, whether we want them or not. And you have to protect them and care for them then, you know, like we're getting a look at the system now when, you know, the options for moms who don't want to be pregnant anymore are fewer. And it's like, I think one of the points in the book is like how much investment one child takes and one child needs. And children are worth it. Like, we should as a society decide that children are worth it, and that like the amount of investment that one child needs is like what that child needs, and we should give it to them. But like the reason what Betsy Woodall was doing works is because she was doing, I will take one child and I will give this child my everything. You know, mm-hmm. Like children need parents, they need families. They don't just need people who are like taking a check. And so our system is like so far away from being able to give that. And these are kids that have come from like bad circumstances and like therefore need much more care than other children. And we should give it to them, but we don't.
No, and we've defunded mental health care, which is ridiculous. And so these children have never seen any sort of psychological evaluation in their lives and have not received any care for their abuse and systems. It's gross.
So this is leaning more on the personal side, but I heard a statistic once that was like, if every church in America took in, it was like one or two kids, there would be no kids left in foster care in America. There would be no orphan children.
Are you?
And right. So, and I've always been like, so I've kind of come to the conclusion, I don't think I want my own kids, but I've always told my mom, like, there are so many kids in this world who need someone to love them that I would love to be a foster parent. So that's always been kind of like in the back of my head, is like, I'd love to foster kids one day. And because there are so many foster parents out there who, there are, you know, lots do it for the right reason. Some do it for a check. And I was like, there are plenty of kids. The world is shitty. I don't need to add more. I could just, you know, love a kid who's already here. And so that's something that's always in the back of my head, is like kind of a goal of mine. I don't think I want my own kids, but I'd love to give kids a safe place to land.
Right.
But I can't do that on a single income. So,
no.
You know. America.
Yeah, kids are freaking expensive.
Right. And if you want to give them what they deserve, like you're saying, like all in, there are so many limitations to that.
Yeah, it's expensive. And then once again, another person in this book who you can feel sympathetic before, but also fails demon in many ways, is Coach Winfield. And then someone who does not feel demon, Angus.
The only person who never fails demon.
Sweet baby girl.
Oh, I love her so much.
I was so happy about the ending. I don't know what that person was talking about. I am so happy for them.
I was like, how did you not see that coming?
Yeah. She was the only one who actually stayed in touch.
They could have had.
Yeah.
It's like the ideal scenario. I wanted it so bad. So anyway, what did you guys think about Coach and Angus and just Lee County teachers, gifted and talented football, etc.?
Well, Coach is like this bittersweet moment because, like, in a way, he fails Demon because he didn't have all of the information.
He's like, just not present. Yeah.
He's just not present. And to be fair, he gives Demon an outlet and gives him a purpose and a team to be a part of, which is a huge thing.
The best shot he had ever in his life was given to him by Coach.
And I'm not saying like football is a must or
fed and clothed and safe. Yes. Yeah.
Has an opportunity for scholarship to get out.
Yes. And I think something that we are really lacking in America right now, for young boys in particular, is a sense of community. Mm-hmm. I think young boys are traditionally staying at home, playing video games, and they're not going to community outlets or community groups. So they're being more isolationist, which is causing a mental health crisis. So what Coach gives Demon is a sense of purpose and a team and a community to be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
What fails is when he's no longer able-bodied to be on that team and he just trusts the first doctor, which, to be fair, doctors and white coach syndrome and people trusting doctors is a very common thing. Mm-hmm. Especially if you have no medical background or any sort of like information. So he trusts the first doctor who basically was just like, yeah, he doesn't need surgery. Like, just give him meds.
He just needs drugs.
He just needs drugs. And then it turns out the same doctor has been like basically flooding the town with opiates. And it's heartbreaking because June comes in and says, I don't think this is right. Like, I'm very concerned about this. Like, we should get surgery. And the coach is kind of like, I'm going to trust this doctor. I go to him for all my other issues. And I'm like, oh, God damn it.
Well, and you get the potential outcome of being the pride and joy of the football team, the only thing the town has to bring them together, in fast forward. And you see how he's still trying to be the quarterback of the football team. That's all he has mm-hmm. to his name, is that one time he was really great on the football field, and other people in the town have that same experience. So that's what Demon is like, oh, that could be me. Like, I could be top of the town. And even the people who look like they're top of the town, you know, are epically failing at life.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you see how, like, this culture, you know, that's all the town has to bring them together on a Friday night. So it's just like the pinnacle. So Coach is all in on it. The town's all in on it. And Coach is missing stuff happening in his own house because of it. And it's really, really sad. But I feel like every town has.
Mm-hmm.
Every rural and suburban town knows what Friday night means, you know, especially every in the 90s. City.
Let's be clear. Every city in the South has Friday night lights.
Texas, yes, y'all. Yeah. But, you know, everyone knows. And it's just interesting watching how the football player who was the top dog and didn't make it out of the town, that was it. That was the peak of his existence.
Like, the definition
Coach was the same way.
Right. The definition of peaked in high school, like, that was the last time they had something that like held them together.
And they were holding on to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's when like Miss Annie and Mr. Armstrong really come in clutch, because they give him another outlet and they give him more teaching and life skills because he's part of the gifted and talented program, which is grossly underfunded. And they talk about that in the book, and he's being mm-hmm. attacked from all sides because he's going against the norms and going against the grain. But it's so important to Demon, and it's so important to his story that he has art and that he has Mr. Armstrong teaching him language arts. And that's what truly gets him out of the cycle, is not just football, mm-hmm. but also this.
There are so many kids who are saved by that one teacher that takes the time to call out something good in them. And that's what you see here. teachers are underpaid, pay them more money. They do important work.
Period.
Yes.
But also, you're right, like Mr. Armstrong talking about, no, it's not funny to be called rednecks. And like, no, the coal industry is preying on you guys and all this stuff. Even though he's a black man in white Appalachia, he's still teaching these kids these lessons when he's experiencing racism tenfold.
Right. And he's sort of the perfect person to do it, though, because he understands oppression and he understands systemic issues and how, you know, not everything is about like person to person. There are systems and companies and governments that have worked against certain people or set up systems against others. And so I loved those scenes where he's like challenging what kids think. And he's like, but why is this place like it? You know, we should be asking why, like, and encouraging them not just to feel less than just because they're poor in Appalachia, but saying, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. Like, you can do all the things other people do. This community has been fucked over.
They've been given zero resources and zero help.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about the most disappointing character in the whole book.
I don't want to do opinion. It. Oh my God.
Let's talk about Dory.
I feel so bad, but oh my God, I just want to kill her. Oh my God.
Too late.
It was sad because when she finally overdosed, you're kind of like, okay.
Now like, Demon.
It was kind of a relief.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it was kind of a relief to Demon too, sadly.
It was. This is why I get why parents get so crazy about who their children are dating, because the person you like and are in love with has so much influence over you that, and again, like Dory is not like a villain. She's her own girl in a really difficult circumstance, dealing with the poverty and the abandonment that Demon also faces. But it's like, she also just like fucks him over, you know, like she unwittingly drags him down.
Influence.
Yeah. She's she's a bad partner. I don't want to say she's a bad person, but she is not a productive person. And she really harms Damon in a lot of ways.
She is a fragile person.
Fragile and selfish.
Damon
and addicted to drugs.
Yeah. Non-functioning person.
Yeah.
Damon is resilient in all fronts. And even though he was addicted to drugs, his addiction, he almost managed it. And I think I want to say he was never going to go overdose, but it seemed like he could manage it to the point of like, he knew his body. Dory, if life threw anything at her, was down for the count and would turn to the darkness and turn to addiction in order to save herself or her mind. And so she
was suicidal.
She was suicidal. And I think she truly did love Demon, but she's very selfish and would never let him go. And so the only way that he was ever going to be let go was her death.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's so heartbreaking being in his head through all that. Like, I think the scene after Dory dies, I think, was like the saddest part of the book to read for me. Because you can understand why he would never leave her. Like, he's been abandoned so many times that he like will not allow himself to leave her, even after he realizes that she's bad for him. And again, like, she's not evil. Like, you feel for her, but the relationship is so bad and toxic. And he wants to live. Like, I know that, like, you know, to a certain extent, if you're addicted to drugs like that, the promises you make are sort of empty promises. Like, he's like, I want to get clean, and then he doesn't. But it's like, he still has that drive in him to pick himself up, to envision a better life, to try and get himself together. He fights to stay functioning even when he's addicted.
He understands you need money to have food, to keep the house clean, to keep the lights on,
Right.
And to stay alive.
The clean right. up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she just doesn't have, I mean, she's just suicidal and she needed all kinds of help that she did not have access to.
Well, I think she put her whole life purpose into helping her father. So when he was gone, she lost her life's purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with no one telling either of them to get back in school, you know, what are they going to do?
Right.
They're now left without their income from her father. And it's like no one's also encouraging them to go out and get a job. Mm-hmm. So they're just kind of like stuck.
Right. I think Dory was, for that reason, a really good illustration of like the helplessness of poverty in like disenfranchised regions like Appalachia. Because if you think about it, it was like, I mean, what was she going to live for? She was like, there's like three jobs here I could do. I don't want to do any of them. I don't really have any like dreams, like other than like, you know, getting married. She's like, I could have kids, but we don't have money. The only thing to do here is drugs. I'm already addicted. How would I get unaddicted? My family's gone. You know, like she has. And there was no one, like Demon always had people watching out for him. And she really doesn't. Like she doesn't have anything to like see to make her want to like
her
live
one person
life.
Died.
Yeah.
And her friends forgot about her.
Yeah.
Right. And so she just, I mean, obviously, like someone who is not depressed would find something mm-hmm. to occupy themselves with and find a goal. But if you're depressed and like there's no help available, you know, it's
right.
A
He's
hard path.
Changing her clothes and cleaning her up. She is mm-hmm. just done.
Yeah. Right. And that's when like Angus, even she never truly like disses on Dory. She
no,
says,
she's like, I like Dory.
I like Dory as a person when she was a giver to you, giving you gifts and like mm-hmm. treating you like you should be treated. I don't like what she's made you. And I don't mm-hmm. like where you are because of her. And that's when like, you know, those Angus moments throughout the books where she was just like voice of reason.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Slay queen. Like she was the sane one in the teenage part of the town.
Yeah.
She was the June of the teenagers.
Yes, mm-hmm. she was the June.
Okay. While Dory's death is sad, stuff still gets worse. So let's talk about Devil's Bathtub. In the meeting with Fast Forward and Big Bear and Maggot and Hammer.
Fucking Rose.
I know.
She is the worst.
He is the worst person. Her and Fast Forward. I mean, Fast Forward you see coming because Demon interprets him differently as a child, but like you as an adult reading it, you can see that he's, you know, a bad person. Yeah. Yeah.
But he shows interest in a kid who no one else shows interest in.
Yep.
Right. And he does, in his own way, care for them. It's not a good way, but it's a way. But yeah, I mean, Devil's Bathtub. Fucking Rose. It was sad, but when this is sort of a weird emotion because you know it's going to be bad because Demon kind of prefaces, he's like, this is when I hit rock bottom. But in a way it kind of makes you happy because you know that like he's going up from here, like this is like the worst point and Demon will get through it and then he will be able to like rebuild his life after.
Well, because I don't think if it wasn't for Fast Forward and Hammer's deaths, he would have truly gotten clean.
Right.
Dory's death was getting him in the right direction, but it wasn't probably enough of a push.
Right. Seeing Hammer dragged into all of this and seeing Maggot's now going to go to jail because of this, like, is what kickstarted his recovery. And he's like, I have to get out. There's too many ghosts here now. I have to go.
And also just like seeing the impact of drugs in real time. Like he's like, if Hammer hadn't taken that hit, none of this probably would have happened.
When he basically contemplates suicide for a bit
mm-hmm.
and you see how that might be his choice. He's like, I have nothing left, nowhere to go. No one who cares about me. And then you see he has this will to live still that he's had this whole book, but then Big Bear experiences the same thing and kills himself later, it mentions. So, like, you see every possible outcome.
Yeah.
And Demon just manages every time to take one more step forward.
Well, because thankfully he had people like June in his corner who are like, you're going to go to Knoxville and you're not allowed back for a year because this town will suck you dry and suck you in.
Yep. Okay. So now we finally get to the ending, which I also love the ending.
Yeah.
So Demon, he gets into rehab, he gets clean, he's there for like 3 years, and him and Angus reconnect and then go on a journey together to see the ocean. What did y'all think?
I mean, I get where the person was saying like it was cliche or something like that, because like we would been prefacing the ocean the whole book where it's just like he wants to see the ocean and then he gets close but never gets there. So like I knew the ocean was going to come back into play where he was going to finally see it.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that he was like slow, like kind of like lurking in the corners of like, so does Angus have a boyfriend? Like probing questions to Betsy. And Betsy's just like, she set her cap on someone, but I don't think she wants me to say. And then he finally realizes it. And it's so sweet because she's just like,
it's like rom-com-ish at that point. Where
oh,
like,
it's so rom-com. And I love it because I fucking love rom-coms. And I needed that little bit of hope at the end of this book.
But it's also
drive off
realistic.
Into the sunset to go see the ocean. It's so cute. His dreams are finally taking shape.
Right. I liked it because I felt like it was the best ending possible without being like unbelievable. You know, right. It's not like everything is 100% perfect. They're riding off into the sunset, but he's finally back on his feet. Angus is doing well. They have supported each other and been with each other through so much. And it was finally the right time. I'm like, oh, yay.
And she's coming back to the area to become a social worker and truly start helping kids like Demon. And it's just
my hope
like,
is he'll be like the art teacher, you know?
Oh, my God. Yes. That would be so sweet.
That's like the dream I have is she's the social worker, he's the art teacher, and they're the new Armstrongs and
Annie. Oh my God.
A positive cycle.
Well, does it deserve a Pulitzer Prize?
Yes.
It does. Yeah, indeed it does.
I agree. The amount of effort it must have taken to write so many, like the more you think on it, the more you're like, oh, there was this lesson in this direction it could have gone, and like even touches on other kinds of addiction in the area when he's in rehab. And like, it just, there's so much packed into this book.
Cause that was like the crazy part is like the adults weren't addicted to the opioids totally yet when we start out the books. Cause that doesn't happen until the 96. Mm-hmm. And then they add opioids into it and it goes full throttle into a ramp up.
Yeah. That's
just wild to me. Cause the meth existed and he worked in a meth lab when he was like 12, which was fun. But
so,
like that was always in the equation, but it doesn't truly take form into this unbearable monster until that happens. No, this book is crazy. This the invisible strings in this book and how much like plots are behind it is crazy.
Yeah.
And there's your Taylor Swift reference for
that. Yeah, I didn't get that.
Yeah. No, okay. Every character comes back. Every character is complex and deep. It was so good.
Morally gray characters. We love it.
We do love it.
Yep. What about book recommendations?
Oh, man.
I actually have one nowhere near close to this level, but I think I've recommended it before. It's one of my all-time favorite books. It's called Before We Were Yours by Lisa Wingate. It's a historical fiction about the Tennessee Children's Home Society and foster care and bad things happening to those kids, many of whom were actually just kidnapped so they could sell them to make money for foster care kind of thing. Also really good, has stuck with me for a very long time. It's much shorter.
That's nice. I have two. The first one, I am going to recommend the Poisonwood Bible. I remember it being a little bit more difficult to read than this one. And as I mentioned earlier, it's told from the perspective of a white family who are missionaries in the Congo. And they are like
sort of the villains in the story. So it's a little bit harder to read from their perspective because they're not intended to be likable. But if you like this book, I think you'll also like that one. It's super well researched, deeply historical, same sort of like morally gray characters who are like caught up in systems, caught up in history, and watching it play out. The other one I'll recommend, which is more reader friendly, is Life After Life by Kate Atkinson. I've recommended it before, and it's probably my favorite historical fiction book. But it's the concept is like one character lives her life over and over again. And she's like special because she can remember her past lives. And obviously most people can't. But in each life, she makes different choices that sort of result in different endings. And so it's also like super, super historical, well-researched. It takes place during World War II. So she's sort of like in and out of the war effort, depending on what life she's in.
Gosh, I'm having trouble. I feel like people who like this book may like Secret History, but I don't want to recommend that because like that was not a book I liked. You know, if you want a shorter book, but dealing with harder topics and dealing with race and truly a white savior complex, Yellowface.
Yeah.
I think people who like this book will like Yellowface. There's not a ton of similarities between the two. If you like vibes. This book, the vibes are very similar. And I think it makes you think a lot more. I mean, I would recommend Babel as well, but that's a really long book. But, you know,
I thought you were going to say A Little Life.
No. I don't recommend that book to anyone.
Yeah. So crushingly sad.
Yeah. The opposite kind of ending to this one.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what that book needed was an ending like this one.
Yeah. Yeah. Even 2 seconds of joy would have improved that book.
Or 500 pages less.
Also true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, rate and review our podcast 5 stars, pretty please. And these are just our opinions. So we would love to hear from y'all, hear what y'all think. You can send us messages at Busy Girls Pod online, pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't always tackle this kind of book, but if you liked it, let us know. Send us more recommendations. So with that, I'm Caitlin.
I'm Casey.
And I'm Catherine. Thanks for listening. And when you get a chance, take a break with the Busy Girls Book Club.